And welcome once again to another edition of A Plain Answer here at Redeemer Broadcasting. I'm Dan Elmendorf. On the Skype line with us today is Dr. Robert Malone. And Dr. Malone, it's wonderful to have you back with us today.
Thanks, Dan, and good to see your wife, Deb, here participating in the conversation.
Yeah, she just walked in the room, so I invited her at the very, very last minute. And she kind of oversaw the health of our family as we were homeschooling. And we had kind of a minimalistic approach to vaccinations. We were careful about that. But the other day, Dr. Malone, you wrote about influenza and the WHO and all of that. Right now, there's something going on again, bird flu and all of this. So I'm wondering if you can kind of bring our listeners up to date on what's really happening.
Yeah, bring you up to date on the latest drama.
Yeah.
It feels like deja vu all over again, as they say. We keep coming back to bird flu. Is this disease X? You know, clearly they didn't get traction on monkeypox and some of the other threats that they floated. And there's a number of things that are fascinating about what's going on right now. Of course, this is in the very last days of the Biden-Harris administration.
Yes.
The former director of the CDC, Bob Redfield, he came out with a statement that was really pretty outrageous, in which he said that bird flu had a 50% mortality rate according to the World Health Organization. Well, that's actually true. The WHO does say that, but they're looking at bird flu historically. Remember, bird flu has been identified as a problem in health, in animal health, since the late 1800s. And was really identified as H5N1 in 1959. So it's been around a long time. It's been circulating between Europe and Asia and the United States. And there have been something like 350 cases over the last 10 years of bird flu. And the ones that get reported to WHO are the people that are the sickest. So, of course, those are the ones that end up dying. And so the WHO says, well, according to our records, is a 50% case fatality rate. But that flies into the evidence that we currently have for the current circulating bird flu, where we have something less than 70 cases in the United States. And wait for it, zero cases of death.
Oh my.
And only a couple of cases of hospitalization. So that, by my calculation, even with the new math, that doesn't come up to 50%. That Bob Redfield, rumor has it that he is involved in some company that is preparing to market a bird flu vaccine. So there's appears there might be a conflict of interest there. There's the appearance of a conflict of interest. And Lena Wen, with her recent statements that the Biden administration needs to roll out widespread testing and needs to deploy on short notice without any clinical trials these H5N1 vaccines that BARDA and the federal government has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to develop and are not FDA approved. Somehow she thinks that in the absence of a public health emergency, it's okay to start jabbing people with a product that's untested. So is there a public health emergency? Well, let's ask that question of the CDC and the NIH, NIAID specifically. So NIAID, this is Tony Fauci's old agency or branch of the NIH that Jay Bhattacharya is going to be driving the bus on hopefully soon. So the NIAID, two top leaders, came out with a statement in the New England Journal of Medicine where they basically said, I'm paraphrasing, the public health threat is low. And by the way, that also is the specific statement from the CDC. The public health threat for avian influenza is currently considered to be low. But the NIH did say, the NIAID, that, well, it's necessary to continue to develop a medical countermeasure or multiple medical countermeasures for avian influenza in case it ever does become more than
ever
low.
Does.
But if that's our criteria, then we've got to be developing things for all kinds of stuff at hundreds of millions of dollars a pop.
Right.
So Lena Wen came out with this statement that was just over the top of boosterism, for advancing this vaccine, which includes, by the way, the mRNA vaccine candidates. And things aren't going so well for Moderna. And Pfizer BioNTech just lost a major lawsuit with NIH. So they're going to drop, I forget what the number was, $800 million more in royalties into the NIAID consequent to this, because apparently they were hiding profits. So the mRNA vaccine product companies aren't doing so well. And, of course, their bottom line would be greatly boosted if we made a big deal out of this. Now, is there a real threat with H5N1? What's the status?
Yeah.
I'm going to start off with the most worrisome thing that's come out. There's a report from Washington State in a rescue facility that keeps large cats. So this is cougars and lynx and bobcats and mountain lions, et cetera, that kind of stuff. And they've had, and a lion, and they've had something like 50% mortality in their large cats. What that comes down to is something like 25 or 30 large cats have died, often with neurologic symptoms, paralysis, or various forms of that, in their facility. So it's about half of their large cats have come down. Now, whether or not there's some other thing going on and bird flu just happens to be on top of that, just like we saw with COVID, where anything that caused a death, if they could get a PCR positive signal, they said, correct, well, that's a COVID death, even if it was a gunshot wound to the head.
Exactly.
It's not entirely clear what went on in that cat facility, and there is no reports of deaths in domestic cats. So all the cat ladies, don't get excited here. There's no fears at this point in time. Now, what has happened is widespread USDA largely driven testing for bird flu. It's never been half done before. And you know how it is. The more you test, the more you find, especially if you're using PCR.
Yeah.
And so what's been revealed is that we don't know if this was happening before. Remember, bird flu goes back to the 50s and really to the turn of the century at least. We don't know if it's historically infected cows, because the cows that are testing positive aren't having any major symptoms. They're getting kind of sniffles. Now, I don't know if you ever worked with cattle, but a runny nose is kind of the standard thing for cows. Runny nose and runny poop is what cows do. So it's hard to say they're not having symptoms, but now that they're seeing positivity, they have gone to the links to try to figure out where it's coming from in the cows, and it's coming from the mammary glands, in other words, the udders, and the tissues in the udders, the cells that produce the milk, support replication of avian influenza, and so it is being shed in the milk. So that's a big deal, but it's readily resolved with pasteurization. Now, does this have a hidden agenda about shutting down the raw milk people? That's for you to speculate and me to shut up about. But that's the state of play right now. And something a little less than 70 people in California, particularly working in the dairy industry, have come out with avian influenza because they're in close contact with the cows. And hence Gavin Newsom's announcement of a public health emergency, because less than 60 workers in California have developed red eye, conjunctivitis, and some mild symptoms. Nobody's going to the hospital. There's one case in Louisiana of a man who is an elderly man who has a lot of pre-existing conditions. He's immunosuppressed. He was handling, presumably works for one of these big chicken barns, and he was handling a lot of bird carcasses, and he got a chronic infection. And anytime you get a chronic infection with an RNA virus, it will mutate and it will evolve while it's in your body. And so he's got some mutations. They're not particularly alarming, but the press is making hay while the sun shines. So that's the state of play right now, and this is much ado about nothing. It's a tempest in a teapot right now. Could it ever get to be something more? Of course it could. Have we been through multiple rounds of scare that go back the last two decades about H5N1? Yes, we have.
Yeah.
Has anything ever materialized or we had widespread death, etc.? No. So what's the probability that it's going to happen this time? I think the CDC and the NIH would agree with me. The probability is low. The risk is low. Mm-hmm. And this seems to be supporting some other agenda. And what that is, we can only speculate. The whole Biden, you know, this is Chicken Little. The sky is falling. Biden has somehow got to jam this thing out in the 2.5 weeks until the inauguration.
It's unbelievable.
He can't hardly go to the bathroom. So I just don't see how that's going to happen.
Well, today we're talking with Dr. Robert Malone, and he's become a friend. I've never met you in person, but we're a great fan. He knows all about the mRNA vaccination. You also know a lot about influenza. You've consulted with the WHO over the years, and you're very careful about telling people what they need to do, like get a shot, an untested shot. And you were sensitized to all this because you were speaking truth and they tried to shut you down. You wrote a book called PsyWar. Can you tell us about your book?
Yes, so PsyWar, Enforcing the New World Order, and the book before that, the preceding book, was The Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Future Coming. So two books out, and I don't know, 1,300, 1,400 Substack essays later, and of which I think 5 or 6 are about avian influenza.
Yes.
Because it's the gift that keeps on giving. And suddenly I'm being interviewed again on avian influenza. This morning it was the Glenn Beck Show. Yeah. The day before it was Alex Jones.
Oh, my.
That's great. Waiting for Steve Bannon to call.
Today we're talking with Dr. Robert Malone. My wife is also here, and she headed up our homeschooling years ago. And she was careful about which vaccinations the children got. Extremely cautious, and there was also limited information in those days. Did you want to make any comments to Dr. Malone here?
Well, first of all, I came in the study here where we're recording because your voice was bad due to your cold.
Yeah, I've
got a cold. I had mercy on you and I came in, but I'm out of my element here. Being with Dr. Malone, we see you on TV quite often, and we're grateful for the research that you're doing and for the voice that you've given to folks who don't usually have a voice.
Yes.
Yeah, I was mentioning to Dan that when our children were little, I was trying to be careful which vaccinations we chose, but my eyes were opened when our 2-month-old had RSV. And then, which actually our granddaughter presently has it, and she's 7 months old. But after RSV, which took its toll, he had chickenpox. And then I went to a well care baby visit, and the doctor wanted to give him, I think it was OPV and maybe MMR, or it was maybe 4 different vaccines, basically. And I thought, wow, you know, he's just getting over all these other illnesses. I don't want to put more stress on his little body. So I declined. Well, out came the document for the naughty parents, and I had to sign this statement saying that if, you know, something happens to my child, it's not their fault because they told me, you know. And that kind of opened my eyes. I started to do some research. So we would withhold, like, on the pertussis, let's say. And then it turns out, you know, after many years homeschooling, we didn't have the school battery of vaccines to have to go through. But when they wanted to go to college, it caught up with them, and they had to take all these vaccines that we did not take prior to that. So I don't know if you want to, you know, shed any light for maybe parents who are going through that. You know, this was in the 90s, 80s and 90s.
It's hard to know what to do.
But I don't know. I don't want to put you in a bad position, though, either. But any thoughts?
So, number one, good job, Mom. Very astute and appropriate. When your child is in a inflammatory situation, recovering from a significant infection, and you spoke about RSV, and then at a later time, chickenpox.
Yeah, 2 months later.
So your child is at that point in a very strong pro-inflammatory cytokine state, and one of the leading hypotheses for the let's say, central nervous system symptoms that are being called autism. There's a case to be made that the definition of autism has been broadened, and that maybe, you know, if you want to look for nefarious intent, by broadening it, it makes it much harder to do good statistical analysis to show association between this or that causative factor, right, because you now have a large spectrum, is the term used for autism. But it appears that at least one of the things going on is inflammation of the brain, central neuroinflammation, and the associated edema, that's a fancy word for swelling, or water on the brain would be a simple word. And when you're in that pro-inflammatory state, you're much more susceptible, I'm going to throw another techie term, to reactogenicity. That's the vaccine industry term for bad stuff happens after you get the jab. And it can range from getting a rash or a area of induration, that's hardness in your skin, mm-hmm, to seizures.
Wow.
Or loss of consciousness. So those are all considered to be evidence of reactogenicity to a vaccine, or to anything else for that matter. So what you're really driving towards is, and by the way, just to say it, as I was listening to your story, the modern version of I have to sign the bad parent document is that most pediatricians now would basically fire you from their practice. That's now widespread, and that's reinforced because they get financial incentives in a variety of different ways to ensure that their pediatric population is vaccinated to a certain level. So if they don't meet 80 or 85 or 90% fully vaccinated children as pediatricians, they don't get their vaccine bonuses. Mm-hmm. Now, those vaccine bonuses are substantial. They're a major fraction of their overall practice revenue. So they don't get to buy the Porsche if you don't have your kid jabbed. And so that's why they kick you out of the practice, is because they want to keep that number up. Okay, and that's happened all across the United States. Now, the more complicated question, it's really behind what you're saying, is which products do I give my child?
Yeah.
And that's where I don't go down that rabbit hole, because that's me giving advice over the internet.
Correct.
But it is an extremely difficult position, and it's worse. My heart goes out to the young parent. Because you'll remember when you had young ones, your life is full of really hard decisions.
Correct.
Stress and sleeplessness, everything else. And on top of that, now, parents who are aware, let's say, of risk and these issues, now without medical training, they've got to make some really tough decisions about exactly this issue. And the truth is that there are no clear-cut answers. You kind of got two options. You can just go along and say, I'm just going to do what the government tells me to do, and you know, double take the hindmost. What that does is you're transferring responsibility and guilt to the government, which is totally unaccountable. You're never going to be able to sue the government, is the truth of it. And so you're saying, well, I don't have the expertise to make the decision, so I'm going to let the government make the decision for me. This is kind of like a lot of things in our lives these days, right? I'm going to let the government decide for me, and then I don't have to think about it or worry about it, or more importantly, I don't have to feel guilty about it. But if something goes bad, but if you take the decision that you're going to go through the schedule and choose and break the schedule up, because it's a rare pediatrician now that will work with you on this.
Yeah.
It's changed since you had little ones. And so if you're going to take that responsibility, you're going to have to own it if something bad happens. Now, the probability that something bad happens with your child is almost zed.
Yeah.
It could still happen. And then you're stuck with, you know, the classic situation that people face if they've had a death of a child, where you, in your marriage, suddenly the two partners are devastated.
Yes.
They're having to grapple with it. They're grappling with issues of guilt and blame and all those kinds of things. And it tears marriages apart.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Yeah.
And so it's just wicked hard.
Yeah.
Situation right now, but you can go online. You can find the package inserts. You can make your own informed decisions. That's your right, as far as I'm concerned. That's the fundamentals of this quote medical freedom.
Yes.
So we should have the right to decide what goes on in our bodies and our children's bodies. Now, these days they're saying, well, no, actually you don't. And if your child is, what, six, they can decide that they're the wrong gender.
Oh, dear.
And it's all that crazy stuff. But
yeah.
Still, in for most of us, like you folks there in the Midwest, where there's still a grain of reality.
Upstate New York, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we're in the midst of liberal land up here.
Yeah, okay, so my heart goes out to you. So,
thank you.
For young parents, I think that, number one, there's a lot of merit to spacing out the vaccine schedule. One of the hardest questions that young parents face, and I just had this question come to me from an important leader in Europe who just had a child with her new husband down in Portugal. And her child was a month and a half premature, and they were asking me, should we get the RSV vaccine? My answer was, no. What you need to do is you need to get the child inoculated with the monoclonal antibody product that is very effective at preventing infection and disease with RSV, and that lasts for, there's two different versions. One has a longer circulating half-life, one has a shorter circulating half-life. So that's actually a lot more effective than getting your newborn baby jabbed with RSV, because as you're kind of pointing out, the very young are susceptible. By the time they're three, virtually all kids have either been vaccinated or they've had RSV.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not seeing kids dying on the street from RSV. The ones that get it are the preemies, the ones that are really young, really sensitive, don't have well-developed lungs, and they need a little more protection. And the way to get that protection is the licensed monoclonal antibody products. And then you're out of the woods on that one. And you'll recall when we were of us, you know, I still have the scar on my nose here from picking a chickenpox lesion on my nose.
Oh,
and yeah. One over here, as I recall. But they used to have chickenpox parties. And the problem is the vaccine isn't as, quote, durable. The protection it provides isn't as long-lasting as actual natural infection. Heard that before?
Yeah.
And so, but now there's almost no circulating chickenpox, so you can't do that. But the reason, potentially, to ensure that you are covered for chickenpox is shingles.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had shingles. I'm of a certain age, and
no
it
fun.
Hurts bad.
Oh,
yeah. So that's a nasty business. But what you don't want is to get chickenpox when you're a young adult, like my daughter-in-law. So a lot of these things that involve pediatric infectious disease, the kids handle it a lot better than the adults do. Why is that? Because they have this organ in our body called a thymus. It sits up in your neck, kind of by your thyroid, but a little lower in your chest, is the thing that educates your white blood cells, your B and T cells, particularly your T cells. And in children, it's quite large. It's very busy doing that education of your immune system. And they're better able to fight off infectious disease than adults, because this gland kind of regresses after it's done its education job, mostly. And then on the other end, we wonder about the elderly, because they're the ones that are really susceptible. The elderly and the very, very young to a lot of these, particularly respiratory. And the problem with the elderly is something called immunosenescence. And what that's a fancy word for when you get old, your immune system stops working so good.
Yeah.
And there's many hypotheses for why this is happening. But best thing you can do when you're old is not get jabbed and rejabbed, but make sure you've got your vitamin D levels up and your zinc levels
Amen.
Up and your things to keep you healthy and keep your immune system functioning well. And a lot of docs won't even draw vitamin D levels. If your doc won't draw a vitamin D level, go find another doc because it's really straightforward. It's not something they taught in medical school back in the day, but the science is totally solid. So yeah. There's my advice to the extent I can give it over the radio. And again, my heart goes out to today's young parent who is aware because they're facing some really hard decisions.
Yeah. Well said. Thank you so very
thank
much.
You. Well, today we've been talking with Dr. Robert Malone. You can follow him online. Dr. Malone, what is the best way to do that?
You can find us at malone.news. Very
okay.
simple.
Very good.
Subscribe to our Substack, and you don't have to pay, but if you do, thank you very much.
Yeah. It's a wonderful cause.
Yeah. And then on the various social media platforms, on Gab, Getter, and Truth Social, it's at R.W. Malone.
Dr. Robert Malone, our friend, Deb and I pray God's blessing on your life and your wife, Jill, and your farm, that God will bless all of that. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Dear listener, please join us next week for another edition of A Plain Answer.